We shall.
Proverbs 25:15. Oh, have I learned this one the hard way too many times.
I think one of your proverbs came up on the daily Bible app the other day.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Kisses of your friend.
27:18.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's it. Yeah. Focus. Gosh, you guys are like herding cats. 25:15.
With a patience, a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue will break a bone.
All right, with patience, our mind says, by forbearance, a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue breaks the bone. What's that idea? What does it mean when you say, by forbearance, a ruler may be persuaded? What's the assumed relationship that this person has with the ruler?
Really close, kind of like a good friend.
Okay, probably less of this and more of this, right? You've got a ruler, you've got somebody in charge who has come up with some idea or what have you that needs to be changed, right? It was a good idea at one point and maybe isn't anymore. How do you persuade said ruler to change what they have put into practice? What does it mean, forbearance and a soft tongue? Have you ever had anybody come to you and say, Mike, that was the dumbest idea I have ever seen. However you chose to do such and such thing. Yeah. What happens when you come to me like that and say, man, why do you teach residency this way? This is stupid or whatever. What am I immediately going to do? I'm going to get mad. I'm going to get defensive. And I'm going to tell you that you're an idiot. And I probably should be more godly in that moment. But if you come to me with that type of argument, I am not going to listen. I'm going to convince you that my way is correct, and even if you're right, I'm going to convince you that you're wrong. It doesn't matter. Now, if you come to me and say, man, Mike, this has been a sweet season of my life, listening to you and Shay and Rick and Brad and the guys that teach, man, this has been a really, really cool 9 months. I see something in residency. I see an opportunity and something that we could do better. Maybe to further bless folks that come through in the years follow. Would you be open to listen to an idea that I have? What am I forced to do at that point? Yes. Say, yeah. Or if I don't, then, man, I'm kind of a jerk, a know-it-all, right? No, we got this figured out. We don't need any input. It's the idea of Andy Stanley, who's a pastor in Atlanta. They have a conference there that they did in their church years ago, and I think they still do it, called Catalyst. And he wrote a sermon on it called Challenging the Process. And the idea is all of us are going to be in positions in life, in ministry. We're all going to have bosses. We're all going to have folks that are over us that have ideas. And as young, up-and-coming, gifted leaders, you're going to see things different. You're going to have ideas that are different. You're going to have things that have not been tried before. And he talks about the idea of how you elevate ideas in the midst of an organization without coming across like an arrogant know-it-all, you know, 20-whatever jerk to a 50-whatever-year-old boss, right? He talks about just this whole concept. So often in life when we're trying to challenge a process, what we do is we challenge a person. And anytime you challenge a person, that battle is always going to be lost, okay? So as you guys are in areas of ministry and even more importantly, just life, and you see opportunities, when you challenge a process, it's always a healthier thing. Challenge ideas. Challenge beliefs, but don't challenge people, right? It works that way in parenting, you know, when I discipline my kids or talking about something, I don't tell them that they're, you know, bad or they're idiots or they're dumb. I may say, hey, this choice that you made was not a great one. This choice is unlike you. This was a bad decision. You're not a bad person. You made a bad choice, and there's a big difference. So works the same way with all people, okay? If you can move around the idea of not, If you can take them off the defensive, if you don't challenge them directly and yet challenge an idea, then you may get some traction to your idea. And if they don't listen to you anyway, then they weren't going to listen to you in the beginning, right? If they don't listen to the idea of, hey, I have an idea, they certainly weren't going to listen to you if you challenged them directly, okay? So there's nothing really to lose in that matter. So you guys will see things differently in organizations that you're going to be in. That's good. You got to figure out how to elevate those ideas where you still come underneath the authority that's been established. And hopefully there's a culture built in a place like that that allows that. And if there's not, then y'all figure out when you're in charge one day how to build that and make sure that there's a feedback loop and people have the ability and opportunity to share. Okay? So I have learned that the hard way too many times by sticking my foot in my mouth and saying stupid stuff and challenging people and putting them on the offensive or what have you. So, all right? Challenging the process. By forbearance, a ruler is persuaded. A soft tongue breaks the bone. Okay? Yes, ma'am, Jane.
When did you start to realize that you had that soft tongue?
Man, if I had a quarter, I probably told you this before, for every time my mother said to me growing up, Michael, it's not what you're saying, it's how you're saying it. All the time. Literally, my wife said it yesterday. We were working together on some Excel spreadsheet, and I asked her to do something. She's like, now can you ask nicely? And she says it tongue-in-cheek, right? Because I'm like, that wasn't nice. She's like, no, it wasn't nice. I'm like, oh, okay. I just have a tone about me that sometimes is gruff and insensitive. A lot of times is gruff and insensitive. So Joseph probably does too, it sounds like. So sweet wife has to remind him as well. Honey. Yeah, so I think a lot of it came after that season of just coming out of, I shared this weekend a little bit, just out of a church situation where my own flesh was elevated and got this all, maybe see myself in a bit of a different light when I had rubbed enough people wrong that it cost me a job. I was, man, I can be difficult to be with. And that, it wasn't like that was fixed when I got here either, so. But you get around enough people that keep saying the same thing over and over, you go, huh, maybe it's not all of you that are wrong. maybe there is the common denominator, right? So it just took a lot of humbling in that. So, yeah. Yeah, Alex.
So this has been a sweet season of my life.
Here it comes.
That might bless future residents.
Yeah.
Starting at 8.
Starting at 8. Man, that's on the docket right now. We were literally as equipping team talking about.
Really?
Yeah, we not 8. So here's the problem. So for you, it's great, right? Sarah, can you come at 8?
No.
No. Joe, can you come at 8? No. So we lose everybody that's a teacher that has a job outside of ministry. So we wrestled with that, and then we wrestled with, man, maybe just do it at night. Like maybe we do. So you take the 7.5 hours that we cram in a week and stick it at Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or something like that, at the evenings. Well, can you all come at night? No, you got kids. No, can I come at night? No. So there's like this, there's no perfect deal. Like, well, maybe we'll do multiple of them. Maybe we'll do one at 6 to 7:30, you know, for the people that have to come early, and then we'll do one at 9 for the people that don't have a jobs or stay-at-home moms that, you know, can drop off kids at school, and then they've got freedom during the day or whatever. Like, man, that's a disaster. Yeah, so now that's a disaster. Anyway, so we've wrestled with a ton of it. Nobody prefers 6 in the morning. My entire life revolves around my residency schedule. My entire life. And literally. So on Saturday morning, I wake up at 4:30 because my stupid body won't sleep anymore because of 14 years of doing this. And at 8 o'clock, don't have a conversation with me because it's like, da, 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 da. I cannot function. I go to bed. My kids tuck me in at night. Because I go to bed so early, they laugh at me. We're trying to watch a movie on Friday night. I'm like, girls, but I've been up since 4. Like, I can't function. Like, I'm 4 hours in front of you guys. You guys didn't get up to what, you know. So they just laugh. So they, oh, that's daddy. So I'm with you. I agree.
I think it's good for the discipline.
There's a part of residency that's what this is about. You know, and specifically for this class, y'all need to learn that. Y'all suck at discipline. Suck as a class. I'm just being honest. Y'all are terrible. It's March, and we still have not convinced you guys how to sit in your seats at 6 in the morning and be ready to go. I counted before we started. Less than half of you were ready to go when it was time to start. It's not because we haven't told you. It's just not a value for you guys. You guys don't care, which is even more offensive, right? I've been doing this for 14 years. First 2 years, I showed up every day, whether I was teaching or not, every day. And then I went through for a year. I did it every day. I've done this 3 times, just like you guys. And then another 14 years of teaching it, 13 years of teaching it on top of this. just not important, right? So the discipline is part of it. So not to rail on you guys. So wasn't my point. But I agree, yeah, to your point. If you can figure out a situation that could not keep people that we want to come in to come in, problem is everybody has 6 in the morning available. They just don't want to make it available. So if we didn't have Academy as a backup option, I think we would reconsider what time we do this. But backup sounds bad. We have other great equipping options in our church. So cool.
Yeah. I'd be mad if you change the time for other people.
Yeah, it's hard. So, but we're still stirring on it. We're still noodling. Other thoughts on that? I'm really in a good mood, by the way, so just trying to be honest with you guys. I've been watching this Navy SEALs deal recently called The Selection on the History Channel. Have you guys seen this? They take a group of 30 civilians, and they take them through Green Beret Navy SEALs training, like exactly what they would go through for like a week, until week, right? And it's ridiculous. It's like you just look at these people, and you're like, I have so much respect for you. Like half the class quits in 36 hours. They're done. I mean, just done. They put them through absolute torture. And the instructors talk about it. Like, man, it's a game. It's a mental game to see who's committed and who's not and who's willing to make the commitment and who isn't. So it's fascinating. But they're just honest with them, right? Yeah, it's so good. You guys ever seen House, the show?
Yeah.
Like, I go House theology sometimes. Like, sometimes people just need to hear what they need to hear. Like, I hope the Holy Spirit's still working through that. But anyway, it's like sometimes people just need to be told, you're an idiot. And your problem is you're an idiot. I need to be told that, so other people need to be told that. So. And it worked after enough time. So anyway, you tell me if I'm wrong or not. Anyway, somebody had a question. Kyle, was that you?
Yeah. How do you challenge the idea of, I don't know, like with the example of your wife telling you, like, it's not, or like your mom telling you it's not what you say, it's how you say it. If you see somebody that is an authority over you that just doesn't, like, keep saying it in a certain way, and you're like, hey, like, I would listen better if you said it differently.
Yeah.
It's, like, how do you challenge that?
Yeah.
Like, out of humility.
You don't. You eat it. That's on them, but part of it is we need to be able to hear that, even if someone isn't saying it in a way that's ideal. My mom was gracious, right, because she's my mother. But there's been plenty of people that have told me that over times that my excuse for not listening was, well, you should have said it differently, or I don't want to hear it, or whatever it may be. But, like, man, that's not on them, that's on me. That's my own pride that doesn't want to listen to that. And it's my excuses. If I can put it back on them and make it their problem with the way they said it or how they said it, you know, and that's the reality of conflicting with your spouse, you know, when you get, like, Michelle and I can get back and forth on an issue, and all of a sudden we're no longer having a conversation about what we're having a conversation about. We're having a conversation on how we're having this present conversation. Well, you said it like this. Well, you said it like that. Well, you said it like that. It's like, well, what are we even here to talk about in the first place? Now we're just bickering at each other about how I didn't respond, and, you know, so, right? So I think in situations like that, man, we got to eat it. And you just, okay, learn the lesson you need to learn. And my our college pastor used to say, how did he say it? His idea was, man, even when someone's basically throwing you garbage, there's kind of meat on every bone. Find the meat, throw the bone. So there may be truth in that statement. Keep that. The way they said it, whatever, toss it and disregard it, right? But learn the lesson that maybe could have been better packaged, but regardless, the lesson's there. So, anyway, for what it's worth, you guys will get to do this. And you're going to have people do it to you, right? They're going to come to you with ideas and thoughts. And so let them sink in and do your best. All right, 1 Samuel, shall we? On that note, Hannah, will you pray for us?
Heavenly Father, we love you so much. We're so grateful for what you have done for us through the cross and through your immense love for us, God. I ask this morning that you would speak through Meg to us and tell us what you want for us to hear and want for us to learn about you, God. I pray that we would believe, having fallen more in love with you today, and that we'd be able to glorify you, and we'd give the courage would give us the courage to take advantage of opportunities to share the gospel today. We love you and praise you in Jesus' name.
Amen. All right. So we are reaching the tail end of kind of the breaking season of David's life, and we're going to see it hit a crescendo this morning in a significant, weird way. There's some strange text that we're going to roll through in a number of ways, theological and then kind of David practically. So walk me through, picking up maybe in his anointing in chapter 16, we see this immediate like rise to fame with Goliath. And then what do we see on the backside of that as we're venturing through 18, 19, and following? What do we see God begin to do?
Start taking things from you.
Yeah. What are you seeing thus far? They don't all have to be peas, but what are you seeing God remove from David's life?
All those crutches.
Yeah, all these things that he's leaning on, right? All the crutches in David's life. I don't know if you guys have been through seasons like that of just stripping. Man, they're not fun. They are not enjoyable. And God's kind of whittling him down to himself and God.
I thought you did a really good job illustrating that in this sermon, this lesson, and how, like Exodus out, God is doing the same thing with Moses, and it's like, what season are you in? Like, I thought that was really powerful.
Yeah, good. I appreciate it, man. Just scratching. Dancing over there. Yeah, it's fascinating to see, and it's just, man, again, as we talk about it, we mentioned it so many times in here, this is such a normative process for God that he brings everybody through, you know, not because he doesn't love us, and not because he doesn't care, but man, because that's part of just the equation of how God works in us. So, as we reached chapter 27 last week, we saw all these things removed from him. We saw God literally in chapter 24 and 26 give David two different opportunities to remove Saul's life, right? Once was in a cave when he and his men were hanging out there, and Saul was going in there to relieve himself, the text says, and his men want to kill him, and David says, man, we're not going to do it. And then in chapter 26, we see it again with Saul sleeping in the middle of his army, Abner's by his side, and David comes in to take his spear and his water jug, and ultimately spares his life yet again, has a conversation with Saul both times, saying, man, I was here, why are you chasing me? And yet God is allowing David these situations, but clearly aren't his will, and David gets that. And in 27, we left off last week, and this is where this chapter started to get really strange. And it's just this weird funk that's in David's head, and he's kind of resigned himself at this point in life that I'm never going to be king. 27:1, you see this kind of pessimistic reasoning with him. He says, it reasons to himself. David says to himself, I'm going to perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. So everything in David's world is just kind of wacky. And we find out that basically he aligns himself once again with Achish, king of Gath, and basically becomes Achish's boy. He's going to be the commander of Achish's army. And for 16 months, he lives with Achish and is his guy going on raids. Now, David's living this duplistic life of telling Achish, hey, I went here when I really went here. He tells him, hey, I've been fighting your enemies, which would have included the Israelites, when in reality, David is fighting common enemies of Israel and Gath, so that he's on the safe side, if you will. But he's extinguishing everybody that lives there, men, women, children, sheep, donkeys, the whole kit and caboodle. Everybody dies so that David can cover his tracks and no one's coming back saying, man, I'm not from so-and-so where David said I was from. I'm actually from, you know, this place, and David's lying to you, Achish. Well, in 29 now, and we'll get to that here in a second, God is going to make David live his lie, which is fascinating. So, and we'll kind of see how that plays out. So 27 ended with this idea of, again, David kind of living in this duplistic world. Now, 28 is kind of a parenthesis in between what's going to happen in 27 and 29. 29, we're going to pick back up on David's story. 28, now we're back in the life of Saul, and we're seeing what's happening kind of behind the scenes in Israel and with him, okay? We are in the home stretch, the last, literally, maybe 6 months of Saul's life, okay? His career is about to be over. He's 61 years old. He's been reigning in Israel for 40 years. He's about to die. Okay, 28:1. Let's pick up there.
In those days, the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army. David said to Achish, very well, you shall know what your servant can do. And Achish said to David, very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life.
All right, so this is the end again that season. We'll pause here now, 3 and following. We're going to pick up on Saul's story. But what's this commitment led to now between David and Achish?
Observant.
Yeah, and like, you very well know what I can do. What is David speaking of? You know what I can do.
Goliath.
Huh?
Goliath.
Yeah, it's the idea of Goliath and then some. Like, you've seen me wreck shop, man. You send me out, and I am, battles are as good as won when you send me. So wherever you need to send me, and Achish says, okay, you're going to be my bodyguard. You're going to be my boy. So the problem is Achish and Israel obviously are not on friendly terms, and there's going to be a day and age where David is going to have to go fight against Israel because of his commitment to Achish. That hasn't happened yet, but God's going to put him in that situation shortly. Okay, now, verse 3. There you go. No, you're good.
The Philistines assembled and came and encamped at Shunem, and Saul gathered all Israel and they encamped at Gilboa.
All right, so we got a battle ensuing, and we find out kind of some of this backstory that Saul, in the midst of his leadership, has removed, mine says mediums and spiritists, witches. Like, the idea is any idolatry that was happening in the land, at some point Saul said, man, we're not having this. Remove the idols, which included mediums and spiritists and necromancers, and we're going to see kind of what that means here in a bit. Now in verse 5, Saul saw that the camp of the Philistines, he was greatly afraid and his heart trembled greatly. And Saul now in verse 6 inquires of the Lord as to what to do in this battle that he's clearly about to lose because he's outnumbered, but God's not speaking to him, right? He looks at the Urim and the Thummim, the prophets, every option that he has, he prays, and God is, man, the valve of blessing is shut off, and God's voice is silent. So Saul has an idea in verse 7, Katie.
Yeah. Then Saul said to his servants, seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her. And his servant said to him, behold, there is a medium at his door.
All right, so a medium. Anybody got a different word or note on what that is? This is like a psychic, a witch. It's an odd deal. So Saul is seeking out some spiritist, tarot card reader, right? These little joints that you see on the side of the road in Fresno. Let me come read your palm. Let me come tell you the future, whatever. That's essentially what Saul is seeking, and he thinks there's power in there. So obviously, verse 8, Saul disguised himself by putting on other clothes. He went, he and two men with him, and they came to the woman at night and said, conjure up for me, please, and bring up for me whom I shall name to you. So he comes to this woman in secret and is going to ask that. We'll see what he asks here in a second.
I've always been taught that it was like fake, but being that it's like referred to in the Bible, and I have like notes on it saying like that they are people who like console spirits of the dead. Does that mean that it's like possible?
Yeah, this is what makes this such a weird text. Let's read through it and then talk about that, because this is odd. As we talk about just the idea of the demonic influence and satanic stuff, there is true power there, right? It's not like all of it is fake. There are certainly some things that are, I would believe, sleight of hand and gimmicks and tricks and what have you that people do, and tarot card reader, whatever. I haven't been to any of those, so I'm speaking in ignorance in the details. I think there is some true power in these. Now, this is an odd deal. So, Emily, as we read through it, you tell me kind of what you see, and then we can discuss it as a group, okay? The woman says to him in verse 9, like, Saul has asked now for, he wants someone to be brought up from the dead. That's his request, okay? The woman says, behold, you know what Saul has done, not knowing that she's speaking to Saul. You know he has cut off those who are mediums, in verse 9, spiritists from the land. Why are you then laying a snare for me, for my life, to bring about my death? If I do this for you, I'm basically hanging myself out to dry. Everybody knows who I am. I'm going to die. Okay. Saul vows to her, verse 10, by the Lord, which is strange, as the Lord lives, there shall be no punishment to come upon you for this thing. So you see, in a sense, how desperate Saul is, right? He's quoting God as he's asking for this clearly thing not from God to be a blessed. It's just a weird situation, okay? Verse 11, the woman says, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" And he said, "Bring up Samuel for me." So Saul wants to have a conversation with Samuel, who is dead. He's died now years ago at this point in the story, to find out what the will of God is. Okay. Now you would assume if this woman is a spiritist, what does she do for a living? Yeah, which would assume that this is a normative part of her job, right? This is what she is assumed to do, which is why Saul goes to her in the first place, okay? Now, verse 12, rather, she's now called up Samuel, however that works, right? Rings him on the phone and says, "Hey, you have a phone call from Saul." This is her response. Emily, read that in 12.
"When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. And the woman said to Saul, 'Why have you deceived me? You are Saul.'"
What's going on here? So she calls up Samuel from the dead. She sees what she says is Samuel, and what's her response? She cries out with a loud voice, and then says to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? I know you're Saul." Why would that be her response? Why would she cry out with a loud voice? What does that mean? What's happened to her in that moment?
Maybe she's frightened.
She's frightened. Why would she be frightened? Yeah, well, this was Saul, not Samuel, doing that, but Samuel probably was behind that as the prophet. Who would you expect to be frightened in this text? Who doesn't normally experience this day in and day out? Saul. What is her job? I bring up dead people. That's the assumption in her job. And yet she sees Samuel, a dead person, coming forth, and what does she do? She freaks out.
Maybe she doesn't really even do that.
How about that? So maybe, and this is my take on this passage, this is a normally some type of, you know, sleight of hand or whatever that would make people think that she does. And all of a sudden she conjures up Samuel, and holy cow, here comes Samuel. And she's not used to that, and she freaks out. Her response seems odd to me if that is the normative part of her day in and day out job. If she works with dead people all day long, then why would that cause her to freak out? So she freaks out, okay? The king says to her now in verse 13, "Do not be afraid, for what do you see?" So maybe she's not really seeing Samuel. Maybe this is, who knows? Like, Saul says, tell me what you're seeing. And her answer is this in verse 13, "I see a divine being coming up out of the earth," okay? He says to her, "What is his form? What's he look like?" And she said, "An old man is coming up. He is wrapped with a robe." And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed down with his face to the ground and did homage. Okay, this whole text is weird. We don't ever see anything like this in the Bible again. Okay, this is bizarre. Verse 15, keep reading there, Emily.
"Then Samuel said to Saul, 'Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?' Saul answered, 'I am in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me and answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams.'"
So Saul's having a conversation with a dead guy right now, okay? Just keep that in mind. Samuel, and this appears to be Samuel. Watch what he says now in 16.
"Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has turned from you and become your enemy? The Lord has done to you as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord and did not carry out his fierce wrath against Amalek, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day."
Huh. Does that sound like Samuel? Absolutely. That's exactly what happened to Saul. That's exactly why he lost the kingdom. You didn't execute your wrath against Amalek, the guy that God said, hey, way back in Deuteronomy, when these guys were messing with Israel coming out of the promised land, they attacked the women and children from the rear. God says, I'm going to deal with them one day. And one day, God tells Saul, you're going to be the guy that's going to deal with them. Saul wouldn't do it. Samuel has to do it. We already read that story, right? But this is verbatim as to what happened. God's torn the kingdom from you. He shut the valve off. He's not having conversations with you. He told you why. Your kingdom is gone, in verse 17, to your neighbor, to David. This is all what we have seen before. So in terms of, is this Samuel? Is it not Samuel? It sure seems like a guy that spent a lot of time with Samuel or Samuel, right? He knows the story. So this seems to be Samuel speaking to Saul. Y'all figure it out. I have no idea, okay? But that's the idea. So now 20, watch what Saul does.
"Then Saul fell at once, full length on the ground, filled with fear because of the words of Samuel."
So who does Saul think it is? Samuel. Keep going.
"And there was no strength in him, for he had eaten nothing all day and all night.
All right, so that's kind of the end of the story. So Saul gets his last rebuke from the dead. 19, Emily, he says one more thing, by the way.
Moreover, moreover, the Lord will give Israel also with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your son shall be with me. The Lord will give the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines.
Okay, 19, what does that mean? Tomorrow you will be with me, you and your sons. You're going to be dead. You're going to be on this side of this conversation, not on that side. So Saul, and Saul has four sons, okay? And she says, you and your sons, plural, will be with me. Okay, we're going to find out that that is the case, that three of Saul's four sons are about to die in battle with Saul in chapter 31, the next day. So there is a voice of like, hey, this is who I am. This is what I told you. So Samuel is repeating exactly what God says. And then he utters a prophecy and says, look, in 24 hours, you're going to be able to come and talk to me all you want, because we're all going to be on the same side of this line. You and your three sons, and we don't see that mentioned here how many, but you and your sons are going to be with me tomorrow. The idea is because of this battle with the Philistines, you're going to die tomorrow. Like, okay, so we see a dead guy issue now a prophecy. So Samuel falls on his face, as you read, eats no food. The woman tries to feed him in verse 21. She sees that he was terrified and said to him, behold, your maidservant has obeyed you. I have taken my life into my hand and have listened to your words, which you spoke to me. 22, she says, now listen to the voice of your maidservant. Let me set a piece of bread before you that you may eat and have strength to go on your way. 23, Saul refuses, I will not eat. However, his servants together with the woman urged him, and he listened to them, and he arose from the ground and sat on the bed. So he realizes this was Samuel, and Samuel literally just issued me my death sentence. In 24 hours, I'm going to be dead. So this is what Saul believes in this moment. The woman came in verse 14 with some food, has a fattened calf, flour, bread, kneads, the whole deal. 25, she finally brings it before Saul and his servants. They ate, they arose, and they went away that night. It is a bizarre story. Okay, theologically, it is a bizarre story. On the surface, it's not super hard to figure out, right? Saul's going to be dead. This is exactly what God promised. We know it's coming. And now, instead of it happening in chapter 24 at the hand of David, or 26 at the hand of David, it's now going to happen at the hand of God through the hand of the Philistines in chapter 31. Saul is going to die. Jonathan with him and his two other sons that we'll see mentioned in the text. And his reign as king is going to be over. Theologically, it's just a weird chapter.
Did they teach angelology where you like went to school there?
Mm-hmm. Angelology, anthropology, and sin was the class. Yep. Yep. Martyrology as well. We took that with.
It's a doctrine of sin.
Yep. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. It took me a second. I was going pneumatology in my head. I'm like, that was a different class. It's a good class. It's interesting. So, yeah, there's all kinds of the spectrum of belief with demons and their activity today and where people land. They're there. They're present. They have power in this world. There is true power that comes from them. The demonic is a real thing. My kids the other night wanted to watch a horror movie. And I'm like, abso-freaking-lutely not. I'm like, no. And they're like, why? And I'm like, kids, we don't mess with evil. We don't watch shows about people getting sawn in half or whatever the heck you guys want to watch. I'm like, absolutely not. I'm like, I don't want to venture into that territory. So for whatever reason, girls were having a slumber party and had a bunch of girls over and they wanted to watch a horror movie. And I was like, man, I'd rather you watch some blood and guts blow something up. Like on that side of the spectrum, man, I can almost deal with that, but no horror, nothing in our house. Like, it drives me nuts. So anyway, that's my take on it. Not right or wrong, but like, oh, we've all watched it. All my kids.
That's a pretty horror movie.
My 11-year-old, my 10-year-old. Ella, cover your eyes. Ella, cover your eyes again. Those are to me, that's different. Just with real life and stories, and this is what a generation went through to protect and serve our country. That to me is a little bit different than. My oldest is 15, 14, and 11. Yeah.
That makes sense.
We watched Band of Brothers, and we watched Saving Private Ryan. Now, they had varying different degrees of eye covering and ear covering, a certain, you know, so I previewed it, and obviously. But the lessons from those movies, like, you need to learn why you guys get to go to school every day in freedom, and why I can come to a place and open my Bible and teach it with freedom, and why we're not occupied by the Germans or the Japanese, and, like, this is You need to learn that. There's a generation of people that gave their lives for this to happen. So I'm okay if they learn. Now, fake, weird, you know, Star Trek, blood and guts for just the sake of blood and guts, I'm not a fan of. But this. So this Mike's movie theology in 1 minute. I think that's from the Lord. You know that their power is limited. In the book of Job is a great backdrop of this. Literally, Satan and God have a conversation at the beginning of the book about what God allows Satan to do with Job. And he is the one that puts the parameters on how far he can push Job, how far he can tempt him, what he can say, what he can't say. So that's all ultimately still in the hands of God, but Satan's power and knowledge is far more limited. So I don't think so. That's in the hands of the Lord. But there is true power there to some degree. So anyway, so yeah, you'll never see this again. It's a bizarre chapter. I believe that truly is Samuel. I believe that this woman is a farce and was a smoke and mirrors type deal. And she sees Samuel for the first time in her career. She's actually called up a dead person and loses it. Can't figure out what's going on. So that's my take on it. There are others that believe, no, she normally does this. It's part of her deal. That's why she got exiled. And she was just scared of Samuel because he's Samuel. I'm like, okay, well, that makes sense too. You know, Samuel's caused a lot of people to freak out when he walks into town. See, also, 1 Samuel 16, the whole town of Bethlehem's like, oh, dear Lord, here comes Samuel. So it's possible. So y'all can study it if you want to. Enjoy it. But odd chapter, okay? Any other questions on that whole theological grenade? All right, 29. Let's go there, all right? So, back to David. 29:1. Somebody pick up there.
Now the Philistines had gathered all their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites were encamped by the spring that is in Jezreel.
All right, so who's fighting? Philistines? Who's hanging out with the Philistines right now? David and his mighty men, all 600 plus of them at this point, and they're fighting Israel. Okay, keep rolling.
As the lords of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, and David with his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years, and since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day."
All right, so David obviously is a very well known at this point, even amongst the Philistines. So he marches in with Achish, and Achish is combining forces with all the other Philistine cities. And Achish walks in with David and his men at the rear, and everybody's like, "Hey, Achish, like, isn't that David with all of his men? Like, what is he doing here?" And Achish is like, "Look, he's been working with me for a year and a half now. Man, we're good. I found zero fault with him. He's changed teams. We're good. So, yeah, he's coming to fight with me. That's his job." And they're like, uh-uh. Verse 4, "The commanders of the Philistines were angry with him. The commanders of the Philistines said to him, 'Make the man go back, that he may return to his place where you have assigned him. And do not let him go down to battle with us, or in the battle he may become an adversary for us. For what could this man, with what could this man make himself acceptable to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of these men?'" What is being said here? The other rulers of these cities are now coming to Achish, and what are they requesting of David? Dude, he's a liability. Why? He can backstab us right in the middle of the army. Like, this is a big farce. He's SEAL Team 6. He's a spy, right? He's like a double spy. You think he's changed teams, but he really hasn't. In the middle of the army, or the middle of the battle now, he's going to turn to be on Israel's side, and now we're going to have Israel on one side and David and his men on the other, and we're dead, right? If you're David right now, what are you thinking? What's going on right now in your head?
I don't want to be David,
that's
for sure.
Unpack this for me.
I don't want to fight my own people, so I hope they send me back.
Yeah, like, this is the greatest gift you've ever been given, right? He's having to live out his lie at this point. Like, 29, Achish is saying, "Great, we're going to fight." David's like, "Game on, let's go fight." Well, for the last 16 months, when David has said, "Let's go fight," what does he go do? He goes off by himself. He fights someone that's an enemy of Israel. It's no big deal. Well, now Achish is there. He's fighting with Achish, and he's fighting his own people. So you're hosed if you're David, except verse 4. You just got a beautiful get-out-of-jail-free card. Oh, gosh, I'd love to fight with you, Achish, but your guys don't want me to be here. They sent me home. This is perfect if you're David, right? Is this not David, verse 5, who they've sung and danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s, right? We've seen that story before. Everybody knows David. Now, verse 6, here's where it all should get oh so much better for David. Tiana, read that. All right, so we're good, but man, my other bosses, they don't like you so much. So keep going.
Now therefore, return and go in peace that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines.
All right, so what's Achish give him? Go home. So if you're David, what are you thinking?
Okay.
I do not have to live my life. This is perfect. Now look at David's response in verse 8.
David said to Achish, but what have I done, and what have you found in your servant from the day when I came before you to this day, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord?
What? What is David's response? I want to fight. What have I done wrong that I can't fight with you? I've worked with you for 16 months. You just said I found, there's been no, I found only favor in your sight. He says I've been pleasing in your sight. I found no evil in you. Listen to these words again. What have I done? What have you found in your servant from this day when I came before you this day, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? Who is he speaking of? Who are the enemies of Achish? Israel, the Hebrews, the Benjamites, the men and women from Judah. These are his, that's his family. What is he saying? He's begging Achish to go fight my lord, the king.
But the Lord is in your case, so wouldn't he be referring to a person?
He is. He's referring to Achish. You. I want to come fight with you. You're my king. You are my lord. He's not talking about God. He's saying, the Lord, the lowercase L, Lord, my king, is not Saul anymore. It's you. If you're David and you're really on Team Israel this whole time, what are you doing after Achish just gave you this free pass to go home?
Peace.
You know, I'm really disappointed, but I understand. You go home. What does David do? He challenges him. He argues and says, I want to fight. My loyalty is with you. Guys, don't miss this. David has been on the run for a decade. He's 30. Dramatic suspense. He's 20. No. He's 30. Like I said, he's 30 years old right now. Promise was given to David at 13. He's been on the run for over a decade. He says in 27 and following, right? This is his lot, right? I'm never going to be king. There's nothing better for me to escape into the lands of the Philistines, 27 verse 1. Do you guys see mentally and emotionally and spiritually where David's at right now? I don't think this is a farce. I don't think David is, he's not thinking clearly. I think he's still loyal to his people, but there's something is happening where David is, he can't tell right from wrong. He's been living a lie for 16 months. He's been killing innocent people. David's life is jacked, and you're going to see him do something that he hasn't done in a long time in the next chapter. What do you notice is absent from David's life? What have we not seen in a while with him? There's no God. There's no worship. There's no Lord. What do you want me to do? And it's going to take him getting stung pretty hard before he wakes up. But I believe this literally is David, I think he would have went and fought. with Achish. And I don't know what the result would have been, but David is clearly begging him to stay. So, verse 9, Achish now replies to David, "I know that you are pleasing in my sight like an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, 'He must not go up with us in battle. Arise early in the morning with your servants of the Lord who have come with you. As soon as you have arisen early in the morning and have light, depart.'" Now, this could have been one of those things, and I give it room in the text for David to be like, "Hey, are you sure?" Knowing that Achish is going to say, "Yeah." So he looks like he's trying to be loyal and maybe is just playing out that conversation. It's possible. But man, given chapter 27 and seeing how mentally upside down David is, how pessimistic his reasoning is, how humanistic he is in the stage of life, how resigned he is just to be, "Yeah, I'm a Philistine now. This is my life," right? Something seems to have flipped in him where he's just, all is lost, right? So, thankfully, God steps in through the mouth of Achish. Verse 11, David arose early, he and his men, to depart in the morning to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel. So they go camp and get ready to fight in the Jezreel Valley, and David and his men go home. I don't know. It's weird. No, it's I don't know. I think sometimes we just want to paint David in a better light than he really is, right? We want to make him the superstar king. And man, I think he's just in a really bad spot. I don't know. I almost think that God kept him from the situation because David wasn't mentally in a place to make that decision. And I think he would have made a poor one. I think I lean towards he would have fought with Achish and against Israel. So
crazy because
it's hard even to say that. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, because we paint this picture of a man after God's own heart, and it's just like right from the beginning they said he was a man after God's own heart, and we can see that mm-hmm. right from the beginning since he was a child,
mm-hmm.
and then now we get up to this point of a prodigal child, and it's just like. And I'm wondering, I'm just thinking, like, man, how long could you prodigal from before you come back?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, if I was to see a brother do that, I'm thinking in my eyes, like, today, if I was to see a brother do that, walk away from the church, mm-hmm. I'm just, in my head, I'm clearly like, man, he must have not been a believer.
Yeah.
And it's just like,
yeah.
No, this could have been a man after God's heart.
It's a good illustration. That's what... Yeah, David's sleeping in the pig pens at this point, right? He is the younger son that said... "Dad, I wish you were dead. Give me my inheritance." So it's weird. So he's going to come back, but I think you get the idea of how much God is trying to break him mentally and emotionally and spiritually, and this is it. He's a broken man and just confused. So now the problem is, look at chapter 30. So David ends up going home. He gets what many needs to get out of the situation. Chapter 30, verse 1.
"Then it happened with David and his men came to Ziklag
mm-hmm.
on the third day that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire."
Now, a couple chapters ago, who was David going to do battle with? You guys remember? The Amalekites. He was spanking them. Now, David leaves home out of the coastal plains, out of the Philistine area, goes east to fight with all his people, and who all stays at home? All the women and all the children, but all the towns are deserted because they're going back to fight against Israel. So the Amalekites go, "You know what? The heck with you. Y'all been spanking us." So now they roll up north out of Negev and they attack Ziklag. Why does it matter who's living in Ziklag? So remember when David came in originally and said, "Hey, Achish, I'm loyal to you. I've come back. I'm fleeing from Saul." And Achish says, "Okay, this is weird, but come live with me." And David says, no. "Who am I to live with a king? Why don't you give me a town that's kind of far away but nearby?" And Achish says, "Okay, you can have Ziklag. Why don't you live there?" So who's in Ziklag? David's wives, all his family. How about the 600 dudes that are with him? All their family. So all the women and kids are sitting at home defenseless as this army who you have been picking on and fighting against now for the last season of your life, walks into your town. And what are they going to do? This is not good. So they overthrow the entire town and they burn it down. Okay? Verse 2, they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone. That literally tells you, the males, anybody that can fight, is gone. And they carried them off and went their way. So they literally just walk into town and say, okay, everybody out. You're coming with us. Grab your purse, get your money, get anything that's valuable. We now own it. And then they set everything on fire and they walk back home. Okay?
I'm
about to find out. Yeah, what's God doing right now? Okay, verse 3.
When David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and his people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep.
And how are you feeling about right now if you're David? Everything's gone. Everything that's valuable to you. You have no home. You have no... Your loyalty at this point is questionable at best to whomever you're loyal to. And you walk into town and you and your 600 men and all of your wives and children are gone. He's weeping. He's distraught. Like God has taken away the only thing that you have that maybe is a constant and something that you get out of bed for every morning like that. David certainly has loyalty to his family as do his men. Okay, David's two wives had been taken, Ahinoam, the Jezreelite. Jezreelitess, as well as Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. So he has two wives at this point. How about David's men? How are you feeling about David right now?
No fault, bro.
Exactly. Read verse 6.
And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters.
All right, stop right there. So all of his men at this point do what? They want to kill him. Like they're discussing, how do you want to kill David? How about we stone him? How about we ram him through with a spear? I mean, they're coming up with ideas at this point. All his men have just turned on him. So David, we've been loyal to you since chapter 22 in the caves of Adullam. We came with you. We were the outcast. You rallied us together. We fought battles with you. We've lied with you. We've covered those lies with you. And we've seen some profit in it monetarily. We've got a nice place to live, but all of a sudden, David's lie comes crashing down on him. He's lost his loyalty with Achish, king of Gath. He's gone. He's lost his loyalty to Israel. That's gone. Now he's lost his family and everything that could be of value to him, his home. It's burned to the ground, and now there's nothing left to say. Let's just kill David and be on with it. But verse 6, Katie, finish that up. Okay. I would say this point right here is rock bottom for David. He's been through all of it. God stripped him. He's mentally jacked. He's now lost his wives and kids and all of his men's wives and kids. And he finally, in verse 6, hits rock bottom. And where does he finally go? Back to the Lord. Why? Because he has nothing else. He's got no wife to turn to, no kids to go bounce on his lap. He's got no other crutches, no other idols, nothing. And his very men want him dead. He's literally alone. So here's where David, I think, absolutely just cracks. And this is where God wanted him. So David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, please bring the ephod to me. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. Abiathar was the priest that escaped when all the priests were murdered by Doeg the Edomite at Nob. This is the guy that David says, man, come with me. I'll protect you. You've got nobody else. Your dad just died as a result of my sin. That's Abiathar. So Abiathar has apparently an ephod or something to discern the will of God. And now David's going to inquire of God. Verse 8. It's either a linen garment that they would wear or some type of like the Urim and Thummim. It almost seems like these terms are interchangeable. Saul asked for the ark, but the word is actually ephod, another translation, during battle. Something to discern the will of God.
You said a linen? A linen?
Linen. A bathrobe. That would have been there. A light bathrobe. Verse 8.
And David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue after this man? Shall I overtake them? He answered him, pursue, pursue, for you shall surely overtake and shall surely rescue.
So who answers? David. God. All right. So that's good. So God has shut the communication valve off with Saul, but not so with David. So God, what do you want me to do? And you guys, you get the impression in verse 6 that we don't see it, that there's something that's happened there with he and the Lord. Like there's been some confession. There's been something where David has cried out. So I'd love to find out maybe if we know if there's what particular psalm was maybe written here. That would be interesting to find out what David said, if we have any record of that. But I don't know offhand.
So Google it.
Find it. I'll look at my handy-dandy psalms chart that Dr. Rick Taylor made, and we'll find out. But regardless, so David says to God, what do you want me to do? And he says, man, shall I overtake him? And he said, yep, overtake him. So David goes now in verse 9. He and his 600 men, he rallies those guys. David pursued. He and his 400 men, 200, were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor and remain behind. So literally David is pushing his men so hard that a third of them say, we can't make it. So they stay with the baggage at this wadi. And in verse 11 now, they found an Egyptian who had fled, in the field, who brought them to David and gave them bread and to drink, and they provided him water. So as they're pursuing these guys, this random Egyptian is found by David and his men. Verse 13, they say to him, to whom do you belong and where are you from? And he said, I am a young man of Egypt, a servant of the Amalekites. Okay, my master left me behind and I fell sick 3 days ago. So we came in. I'm from the Amalekites. We were, by the way, the guys that just raided your land. I got sick and my master said, you're of little value to me. Stay here and die, basically. And David comes upon this guy, nurses him back to health, and says, man, I want to know more about what's going on. So the guy tells him in 14 what they've been doing. We made a raid on the Negev of the Cherethites and on the Negev, or the portion that belongs to Judah, the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. We've been outworn, buddy. In your hometown, these are all your people. When David said to him, then David said to him in verse 15, will you bring me down to this band? I want to know where the Amalekites are camped. Will you take me to them? And the guy says, man, 15, I'm down. Don't kill me. Promise me you won't kill me. I'll take you down to them. And in verse 16, David promises and swears to him that he won't kill him. And this now Egyptian, in verse 16, takes David to the Amalekites who are enjoying their spoil. Verse 16, somebody read that.
And when he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah.
So these guys are having their post-war party. They're probably not in fighting mode, right? 17, David slaughtered them all from twilight until evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode camels and fled. David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken, and he rescued his two wives. Nothing of theirs was missing, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil, or anything that they had taken for themselves. David brought it all back. So what does God do in the midst of this? Amazingly gracious, right? David could have lost men, he could have lost women and children in the midst of this, and God, for whatever reason, divinely protects all his men's families and their stuff. And David gets it all back.
That's a lot of men that
get away. 400 dudes is quite a few, yeah. Which tells you, it's the text reads kind of funny, not a man escaped except 400. Like, how many do you have when a small amount is 400 that escape? Like, you realize they got a lot of people there doing battle. So the idea is if David's 400 men can obliterate this army, the army is already obliterated, literally. They're having a heck of a party afterwards.
What would be the difference between the text saying man, not a man, escaped, except for the young men who rode camels? Like, were they like slaves or servants or...
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good distinction.
It didn't say sons.
It doesn't. I would assume they're all just Amalekites in some regard. I don't know why that they would be called young as opposed to the men. That's a good question. No idea. Maybe they're more able-bodied, or maybe they couldn't drink yet. I don't know. Maybe they didn't have fake IDs. They're all under 21, so I don't know. But regardless, in the midst of this, God protects them, right? David came, verse 21, to the 200 men who were left and too exhausted to follow David. And his men, this is interesting, right? So 400 go fight, 200 stay back with the baggage, and his men say, 22, then all the wicked and worthless men among those who had went with David said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except to every man, his wife, and his children, if they may depart and go away. So you see the type of guys that are with David. These are not all the bright and shining moral examples of godliness. What is their suggestion, given that 200 guys stayed behind? Yeah, we ain't giving them jack, man. They were too tired to come fight. Like, this party that goes... Okay, here's your wife and kids back. We're not keeping those, but you're not getting a dime. So, and David says, man, that's not going to happen. Verse 23.
Even not do so, my brothers. With what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered us into the hand of the band that came against us. And who will listen to you in this matter? For it is his share who goes down to the battle. So shall his share be who stays by the baggage, they shall share alike.
So David's basically saying, man, whether you stayed here and you protected the luggage or you went down to battle, everybody's getting the same share. Okay, it's called socialism. I don't know. It's an odd deal. Yeah, I'm teasing. David's saying, listen, why would David care so much about those 200 men?
They're still his men.
They're still his men. And what have they been doing for the last years with David? Fighting, being faithful. I mean, yeah, this day, David drove them so hard, there were 200 that couldn't go fight. He's loyal to them because they've been loyal to him. And he says, man, we're not going to do that. Yes, they had an off day. And yes, we made life really hard, but they're still my men. So we're going to protect them and we're going to take care of them. So he says, may it never be. And literally, it says in verse 25 now, it's an ordinance in Israel to this day that that's how, moving forward, they would handle situations like this. So David creates literally law or... just some history here, if you will. So 26 now, David came to Ziklag. He sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemies of David, or spoil of the enemies of the Lord, rather. 26, this is fascinating. So David gets back home. He has all this spoil from the Amalekites, and now he starts sending it out. He sends FedEx packages over 27 through 30. All these places are listed where David sends spoil. Verse 31, you get a summary statement of where David sent those to. Alex, read that.
And to those who were in Hebron and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go.
What does that mean?
He's giving thanks for all of the places that looked over him and was like, dude, I don't have any money. I need a place to stay. And they're like... Well,
exactly.
We'll give you a room and board. We'll take care of you for an extended period of time. Yep. And now he's like, dude, I've not forgotten.
Isn't that cool? What does that tell you about the character of David?
Making amends.
Yeah, he's making it right. Like, hey, look, you guys went out of pocket to feed us, to give us places to stay. That was a tremendous inconvenience. It was costly. David now says thank you. That's pretty cool. You see why the people are going to be inclined to follow David. David's going to be king. He could have easily just said, what the heck with all y'all? I don't know you a dang thing, right? You wonder if Saul would have done the same. David is, he's loyal. He just says, man, thank you. You see this very, very high loyalty meter in David. Rick made a fascinating observation about David. I thought it was, like, it just one of those, you said it, and you're like, wow. Great leaders, people are always, there's a sense of loyalty to them, right? One of the things that makes magnanimous leaders the way they are is that people are loyal to them. What's different about David is that David is loyal to his people. That's not always the case. There are people that are willing to die for David. David is willing to die for them. You don't see that very often. And that's what's going to make David a great king. It's unique. There are people that are willing to die for Saul. Do you think Saul's going to take a bullet for some random Benjamite? Not a chance. David's men are loyal to a fault to David, and David is loyal to a fault to them. The one time in here where we see David almost like go ballistic and lose his temper is when Nabal says, I ain't going to feed your men. I don't care if they've been taking care of my sheep or not. Like, who are you that you ran away? There's tons of people that are escaping from their masters, and David's like, you can just see it boiling up within him. That's the kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back, if you will. Remember that as you guys get into leadership positions. There will be people that are insanely loyal to you because of who you are and your character and your nature. You just don't see that reciprocated. And the reason being is because leaders think too much of themselves. They're too caught up in their own ego. They're too caught up in their own whatever. Go ahead, Troy.
Nothing in mind.
So think about that. It is a leadership quality that is rare. You just don't see it a lot. Okay, so as you guys are put in positions of leadership, that is true servant leadership. There's another guy named Jesus in our New Testament that also shared that quality. Okay,
yeah, right.
Totally.
We're gonna read about him.
Yep. He actually dies for his people. So, sorry, not to be tongue in cheek about that. That's actually not funny, but you get the idea. It's just rare. This is a Christ-like quality that you would lay down your life for your others, and it's exalted. So. One of the things I love about David. All right. So he sends gifts. Brilliant. Now, 31. Here's where it all goes south.
It's like a. So this is what happened while David was going back, but then.
Correct.
A snapshot at the same time.
Same battle. Same things happening. As David's returning from war that he can't go fight, here's what's happening on the battle line. See also Samuel's prediction to Saul. Yep.
Now, the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa.
All right, Mount Gilboa is a mountain chain in the Jezreel Valley. Jezreel being the biggest area of fighting. Armageddon is going to happen in the Jezreel Valley. This is kind of the biggest open plain that you can fight in. So the Philistines are killing folks on Mount Gilboa, and look who dies.
The Philistines overtook Saul and his sons. Struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Melchishua, the sons of Saul.
All right, so Saul dies here in verse 2. Jonathan dies and his two other sons, Abinadab and Melchishua. He has one other son whose name is Ishbosheth. He's a few years younger than Jonathan. Jonathan is in his 40s at this point, 43, 44, something like that. And the youngest son, it looks like, of Saul survives this battle. Whether he was here or not, we don't know. Either he escaped from the battle and wasn't slain, or he wasn't here. Ish means man, and Bosheth means shame. His name literally means man of shame. You talk about a terrible name. Jonathan's going to have a son whose name is Mephibosheth. It kind of means a very similar thing, from the mouth of shame. It's a fascinating play. So Bosheth can mean shame. It can also mean Baal. So there could be some play on words there, but it's a really unfortunate name. You know, it's this kid got a lineage of like you're a doofus and you're a shameful kid. And you're going to learn a little bit about Ishbosheth's personality here in a bit, who he was. He's going to come on the scene here in 2 Samuel. But he's the one surviving son of Saul. Okay, so the battle, verse 3, went heavily against Saul. So here's how it goes down. The archers hit him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. So he gets hit by an arrow. He is mortally wounded. He is going to die, but he's not dead yet. Okay, Saul says now to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword, pierce me through with it. Otherwise, these uncircumcised will come and pierce me through and make sport of me." Meaning, I'm going to be a laughingstock to the Philistines. They're going to take me. I'm going to be their clown. They're going to drag me into their town. I'm going to be their trophy. So just kill me. I don't want to give any honor to them in putting the king of Israel on display and making their day better or elevating their god Dagon. You kind of get the point. Okay, his armor bearer says, "No, not going to happen. I would not do what he says." He was greatly afraid, and rightly so. Like, man, I'm not going to pierce the king through, whether you're mortally wounded or not. I'm not going to finish the job. So Saul took his sword and fell on it. What does that mean? Yeah, he killed himself. Okay, keep rolling to verse 5. Yikes. So that's a loyal armor bearer. Like, okay, I guess I'm going to die too. So now when it's you and a gazillion Philistines, you know, I guess that sounds better than being tortured or all the other things that they're going to do to you. I can't imagine that the Philistines were a really nice, gentle captive, right? Or captivator, what's the word I'm looking for? Captor. There you go. They both die. Saul with his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men died together that day, exactly as Samuel predicted, right? You're going to go down. You're going to be with me tomorrow. And that's where we're headed.
When we were in Lebanon, the people there, the citizens, like, hated Israel. Like, you don't even say the word Israel. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't even call the country Israel. They call it the people of the south,
mm-hmm.
or them of the south,
mm-hmm.
you know, land of the south.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's not even referred to as Israel.
Yep.
And so I'm assuming because Philistine, similar to Phoenician, to
mm-hmm.
Philistine,
mm-hmm.
we're all the same area.
Absolutely.
Is it a very similar, or just maybe even more elevated hatred towards this particular city, like Israel? Like, oh yeah, those guys, we hate them. So what they would have done to the king would have been...
Absolutely, yeah. They are arch enemies and have been now for centuries, since Joshua's day. These are the people that came into, if you're a Philistine, these are the people that came into our land and are trying to kick us out and remove us. So, and are murdering all these folks because God, their God says that this is their land. So yeah, the hatred is strong. I was in Bethlehem eating lunch on one of our trips to Israel. And Bethlehem is Philistine. It is Palestinian controlled. Philistine, same people, two millennia later. Thank you, Mike. There we go. And there was this, I was asking some gal on the street about this sticker that I saw on a car window. Like, hey, what does this mean? And I said to her, hey, I've seen these all over Israel. What do they mean? And she stopped me and said, occupied Palestine. And I said, yeah, I've seen them all over Israel. She said, occupied Palestine. Wow. Like, she wouldn't even let me use that word. So to them, foreigners are in their land, and it's called occupied Palestine. They don't use the name Israel. They don't acknowledge it on a map. It's occupied Palestine. And she went from like zero to nuclear in 1 second when I said, I was like, shame on me. Like, I forgot where I was. Like, yeah, I'm a pro-Jewish, pro-Hebrew person in the middle of Bethlehem. And there's very few of those there.
I have two questions. First, why do we acknowledge it on a map of the controllers?
Israel? Because the United Nations in 1948, gave Israel status again. So the one thing that they have done for Israel in the last 70, 80 years is that. Other than that, the UN can...
So globally.
Yeah, they haven't been real nice to Israel. Yeah, so globally they are recognized, yes. They are very, the UN, very anti-Israel today. Bad. No, the UN is. The United States, Britain, there's a couple countries that will still fight for Israel. Germany actually is one today that is very pro-Israel, if you can believe that. But for the most part, it's ugly. They are a hated people group. It's insane. So, yeah, that's why. Yeah. Yeah, theologically, what do you do with that? Yeah, I think we see Saul in heaven. I think he's going to be a bit off in a lot of things, just like you and I are. So we'll pass through, but maybe not unscathed, if you will. So yeah, I think so. I think you'll see Saul on the other side. Yeah. Y'all figure that one out. So 31, we've got now David... Saul, his three sons dead, his armor bearer is dead. We find out the rest of this story. And by the way, 7 and following of chapter 31 is pretty neat. Okay, when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley, who heard about what had happened to Saul, they fled and now abandoned the cities that they were in, and the Philistines came and lived at them. So literally, the Jezreel Valley and all the cities that Israel was occupying, they're gone. And the Philistines come in now to Israel. This is, by the way, Saul, I told you, loses more land than any other king. This is the least amount of land he's ever occupied. And the Philistines are on him. There's people coming in now from the east side, on the other side of the Jordan. They have this little foothold in the land at this point.
Isn't this kind of like where we started when Saul became king? Like, Saul had a small amount. They were fighting over Jezreel. and then he like took it, but then lost it, and then took it again.
But they had more under Joshua. They had more land. Saul has lost and lost and lost and lost. It's just gone south. So yeah, we had more, even without, even with the incomplete conquest of the land, significantly more. And I'll find you guys one of the charts here in a bit that can, that I think even color codes it and shows you how much they had. But it's frightening. Okay. Verse 8, welcome to why Saul didn't want to go home with the Philistines. Read that. Wow. So what are they doing with Saul's head? Yeah, they're parading it around their town. And watch what else they do. In verse 10.
They put his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan.
Hold on. So they literally take his body and strap it up on a wall. Sean and I stood literally at that wall a couple years ago at Bethshan. It's a city in Israel, in the outskirts of the Jezreel Valley, and they literally put Saul's dead, beheaded body on a wall.
Is it like a big wall, a tall wall?
The city gates, the outside wall of the city.
That was common practice for...
Absolutely. I mean, you've got the king. He is a clown to you. In Israel, you weren't allowed to do that, by the way. Remember the law in Deuteronomy? You don't hang someone overnight from a tree. You bring their body down. So Saul has been dishonored. Word gets back to Israel that he's been dishonored. They have his head. Now watch, this is fascinating to me. Where in the world does this come from? Verse 11. Where is Jabesh or Jabesh Gilead? Where have you heard of that town before? Think hard. Bonus points. I'll buy you Magnum Bar in Israel. The opposite of by the coast.
Is it across the
it's across the Jordan River. Okay? Do you guys remember the story in 1 Samuel? I think it's 11. Saul had just been coronated king. He's out plowing oxen in the field. And word gets to Saul that the men of Jabesh Gilead have just been occupied by a guy named Nahash, whose name means snake. And Nahash says, I'm going to gouge out your eyes. And they say, hey, how about you give us a week to see if anybody will come rescue us? And the guy's like, we're not making covenants with you. I'm poking out all your eyes. And they give him a week. And what does Saul do? He cuts the oxen in pieces and FedExes it all over the land and say, may the same happen to you if you guys don't come show up and fight. 200,000 to 300,000 people come and fight. Saul takes them across the Jordan River, spanks Nahash, and delivers the men of Jabesh Gilead from certain death and eye gouging outing. Okay? These guys now, 40 years later, hear that Saul's dead. And his headless body is hanging on a wall in the middle of occupied Philistine territory at this point. And what do they do? Keep reading.
All the valiant men rose and walked all night. And they took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan. And they came to Jebesh and burned them there.
Keep going.
And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jebesh, and fasted 7 days.
Dude, those guys are bad. 40 years later, they are still grateful for Saul and what he's done, and show their loyalty to him by getting his body off the wall in the middle of the night, plus Jonathan's and his other two kids, bring them home, burn their bodies, and bury the bones underneath the tamarisk tree in Jabesh Gilead. That's awesome. Like, these guys are fiercely loyal to Saul in a really cool way. So, and again, this is literally 40 years later. So,
but fiercely loyal to the idea of what Saul was in that day, because obviously he made many changes and mistakes along the way. I don't think it directly affected being over the Jordan.
Yeah.
But in that act of this selflessness of Saul.
Yeah.
I think that's what
it's not forgotten, right? Gratitude remembered and repaid, which is pretty cool. So remember these guys, though, again. We're going to see them again in a bit. What's, by the way, the problem when you show your fierce loyalty to the dead king and you got another king coming? How do you think David's going to feel about that? That's going to be an interesting issue for them, right? They put their cards on the table. We're pro-Saul. What do you do with that as an up-and-coming king? How do you deal with that? And if you have the character of a guy like Saul, we can think of through how Saul's going to do it. So chapter 2. 2 Samuel picks up right where we left off. Okay, this is essentially one book that's been divided into two. We talked about the theme of 1 Samuel being the idea of preparation. We're preparing David for the kingdom. What do you think 2 Samuel is about? Yeah, it's the establishment of the kingdom. So we're going to see David now finally get the throne. Okay, 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1.
Now it came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David remained 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And it came about when he came to David that he fell on the ground and prostrated himself.
So David's still in Ziklag. He has no idea that Saul's dead. And this guy shows up in the town, and here's what he tells him.
And David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said, "I've escaped from the camp of Israel." David said, "How things go? Please tell me." He said, "The people have fled from battle, and almost many of the, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul..."
Yep.
"And Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also."
Oh, man. So David has got awful news. Israel just lost the war, assuming that David's got his head on straight, which it looks like he does now. Saul's dead, the king's dead, and Jonathan and the rest of his sons are all dead. This is a bad day.
"But David said to the young man who told him, 'How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?'"
Now, this is fascinating, okay? I want you to listen to the story and tell me what's wrong with it.
"The young man who told him said, 'By chance, I happened to see on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen pursued him closely. Then he looked behind him, when he saw and called to me, and he said, "Here I am." And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered, 'I'm an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me, because my life still lingers in me.' And so I stood beside him, and I killed him, because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I have brought it here to my lord."
All right. So what's this guy say?
"I'm the armor bearer."
Yeah, I'm the armor bearer, right? And I was there, and Saul said, "Pierce me through," so I killed him. Now, we got the story in 1 Samuel 31 of how it actually went down. What's this guy doing? What's his angle?
Vice president.
Yeah. And what does he have with him? What does he bring back to David?
Jewelry.
"I have proof. Here's his crown. Here's his gear. Is this his stuff?" Yep. So he's trying to show loyalty to David. He's trying to save his own backside. He's an Amalekite. He's not even a Hebrew. So he has no loyalty like to Saul or David or anybody. He sees an opportunity. And he's like, "Man, I can get... Maybe I'm not going to be loyal, but surely these are valuable things to David, and I will get paid for them, right?" So he's an opportunist. So problem is, he doesn't know David's theology. Keep going, Alex.
"Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and also did all the men who were with him. They mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the people of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. David said to the young man who told him, 'Where are you from?' And he answered, 'I'm a son of an alien and a Amalekite.' Then David said to him, 'How is it that you are not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?'"
Wow. How in the world could you have such audacity to try to take the life of Saul? Like, even as an Amalekite, you should have known better. And this guy didn't actually kill Saul. He just said that he killed Saul. So David called for one of his young men and said, Alex, keep rolling.
"David called for one of his men and said, 'Cut him down.' So they struck him and he died."
He murders this guy for killing Saul. Like, man, that is how serious David takes the office of king. What does Saul's death mean for David?
He's king,
right? This should be, if you're a lesser man, a moment to celebrate. And good. Like, man, it was 24, then 26, and I tried to kill him, and God wouldn't let me, and I let him go. Like, finally, God, you know, in a sense, you would be vengeance. And yeah, Saul, you got what was coming. That is not David's response at all. His men mourn. David mourns. David is going to write a psalm that we're going to read right now. It seems so backwards that he could respond this way. But again, it gets to what is in the heart of David. "Your blood," David says in verse 16, "is on your head. Your mouth has testified against you that I have killed the Lord's anointed." Man, if that's what happened, then you deserve death. And David slays him in that moment. And in 17 and following, here comes the psalm. David chanted with this lament over Saul and Jonathan, his son, right? Obviously, we know David is tore up with Jonathan. We get that. Like, that, that picture's obvious. He just lost his mentor, his buddy, one of the only guys that was there for him in the moment. 19, Alex, pick up there.
Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How have the mighty have fallen? Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, or the daughters of Philistine will rejoice, and the daughters of the uncircumcised will exult.
We've seen this before. Don't talk about it in Philistine. We don't want them to be the rejoicing in these pagan cities. Keep rolling.
O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor fields of or offerings. For there is a shield of the mighty as the shield of Saul, not anointed with oil.
He's literally calling for a famine and for a drought in the land where Saul died on Mount Gilboa, to show that the land would even cry out because their king died. Keep going.
From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life and in their death, they were not parted. And they were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions.
Father and son die together in battle, right? This is a big thing. Now watch where he turns his attention to in verse 24.
O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel.
Weep for who? Saul. Because what did he do in 24? Who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How's your time been as an Israelite underneath Saul for 40 years? Not horrible. Yeah, he's taking care of you. So he finds the positive thing to say about Saul in this moment. He is taking care of you. Was he the best? It's not a time for that, right? This is a funeral speech. So he talks about the positive qualities of Saul, and now he turns to Jonathan.
How have the mighty fallen in the midst of battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me has been wonderful in the love of women. How have the mighty fallen? And the weapons of war perished.
And we've talked about this idea before. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of woman, than a woman. The idea being that some people have proposed that David was gay. Now, what could be the other interpretation of that? Why would David say, your love to me was better than the love of a woman, of my wife?
Well, he didn't have that loyalty to his wife. His wife was Saul's daughter.
Yeah, Michael's out. She's married to somebody else right now. Was she loyal? Uh-uh. He's got two other wives that we don't hear a whole lot about, other than Abigail's beautiful. And she's got this other wife that's in the picture. What are you assuming that isn't there with David and their relationship? This fierce loyalty and love. But what has Jonathan been to him? He's the embodiment of loyalty, the embodiment of selfless dedication and love. It's what marital love should look like, in the sense of laying down one's life for another, letting their needs be greater than my own. Though I could be king, Jonathan says, I'm laying that down for you. So I think that's the illustration of he has been so fiercely loyal and selfless to me, it's better than the love of even a woman. Does that make sense?
So it's even beyond like the idea of the proverb idea of there's a friend that sticks closer to their brother.
That's Jonathan. Absolutely. Like, man, this is off the charts friendship. So he's wailing. But notice, it's not just Jonathan. It's David, it's Saul as well that he mourns for and calls the people to mourn for. So David feels a true sense of mourning for Saul, even though this guy tried to kill him. We're losing fingers to count how many times he's tried to take his life. But now it's over, okay? Tomorrow we'll pick up in chapter 2, and we'll see now David's kingdom begin. This psalm. I don't know if it's recorded in the Psalms or not. I'll look. But this is the psalm that David wrote. I'll check it out. Thank you.